Hitler's War by David Irving. One Day the World. By early 1937, the Nazi state could be likened to an atomic structure. The nucleus was Adolf Hitler, surrounded by successive rings of henchmen. In the innermost ring were Goering, Himmler, and Goebbels. Privy to his most secret ambitions and to the means that he was proposing to employ to realize them. In the outer rings were the ministers, commanders-in-chief, and diplomats, each aware of only a small sector of the plans radiating from the nucleus. Beyond them was the German people. The whole structure was bound by the atomic forces of the police state, by the fear of the Gestapo and of Himmler's renowned establishments at Dachau and elsewhere. There were advantages to being Führer. He had paid no income tax since 1933, neither on the royalties for Mein Kampf, nor on the license income for using his likeness on postage stamps. The facts were kept carefully secret, but he cared little for his image. He resisted every attempt made by well-meaning people to change his postman's cap, his crinkly boots, and his outmoded mustache for styles more suited to the 30s. He desired neither present publicity nor the acclaim of posterity. He wrote to Hans Lammers, directing that if the British Who's Who really insisted on having details of his life, they were to be given only the barest outline. As he explained years later, in a secret speech to his generals in 1944, when they protested at his harsh decisions on the Russian front, quote, "It is a matter of supreme indifference to me what posterity may think," end quote. Early on November 1937, Hitler told his staff that an outright Franco victory in Spain was not desirable. Quote, "Our interest is in maintaining existing tensions in the Mediterranean," unquote. That Franco was fighting the communist-backed Republicans was of only secondary importance. In April 1938, Hitler would muse out loud to Reinhard Spitze, Ribbentrop's private secretary, quote, "We have backed the wrong horse in Spain. We would have done better to back the Republicans. They represent the people. We could always have converted these socialists into good national socialists later." The people around Franco are all reactionary clerics, aristocrats, and moneybags. They've nothing in common with us Nazis at all. End quote. His relations with Mussolini were equally illogical, springing from nothing more substantial than what he termed in Mein Kampf as, quote, "intense admiration for this great man south of the Alps," unquote. He lavished gifts upon the Italian dictator. Henriette Hoffman has described how Hitler was to be seen in his favorite Munich cafe with a bookbinder, inspecting leather samples for a presentation set of the philosopher Nietzsche's works for Mussolini. Hitler rubbed the leather skins, sniffed them, and finally rejected them all with the pronouncement, quote, "The leather must be glacier green," unquote, meaning the bleak blue-green of the glaciers from which Nietzsche's Zarathustra contemplated the world. Despite Hitler's official visit to Venice in June 1934, Mussolini had gone his own way. Austria remained a bone of contention between them. Now that they were allies in Spain, however, the Duce began to refer to an quote-unquote axis between Rome and Berlin. In September 1937, the Duce was Hitler's guest for a week of the biggest military maneuvers in Germany since 1918. Hitler showed off Germany's new weapons and machinery, like the high-pressure steam turbines being built for the new battlecruiser Scharnhorst. In Berlin, the Duce addressed a crowd of 750,000. Afterward, a cloudburst brought Berlin's traffic to a standstill. At the president's palace, the Duce, soaked to the skin, encountered German officialdom at its most mulish, for a house rule dating back to the mists of Prussian history prohibited residents from drawing hot water for baths after 7 p.m. The German public found Hitler's interest in Mussolini as incomprehensible as his shift to a pro-Japanese policy in the Far East. Until 1937, Blomberg, the army, and the foreign ministry had persuaded him to maintain an influential mission in China. The expectation was that the Chinese leader, Chiang Kai-shek, would exchange raw materials for German guns, ammunition, and arms factories. Hitler saw Chiang as corrupt and wife-dominated, however, and predicted that his lack of contact with the people would drive the Chinese into the arms of the Bolsheviks. In 1936, he had authorized German-Japanese staff talks in Berlin, initiated by the Japanese military attaché General Hiroshi Oshima and Ribbentrop's bureau. Again, the foreign minister Neurath was left in the dark. After the Japanese declaration of war on China in June 1937, Hitler canceled German aid to China. Ribbentrop demanded a military tripartite pact between Germany, Japan, and Italy, quote, in anticipation of the inevitable conflict with the Western powers, unquote. The pact was signed in Rome on November 6, 1937. It was concrete evidence of Hitler's smoldering disenchantment with the British. Ever since 1922, Hitler had looked on Britain as a future partner. He frankly admired the ruthlessness with which the British had grasped their empire. He had devoured volumes of English folklore. He knew that the three white rings on sailors' collars denoted Admiral Horatio Nelson's victories. He had repeatedly affirmed, quote, the collapse of the British Empire would be a great misfortune for Germany, unquote. Now he began sketching vague plans for assisting Britain if ever her colonies in the Far East should be attacked. Ribbentrop shared his sentiments. He had already introduced numerous influential Englishmen to the Führer. In 1945, the Americans captured the transcripts of some of these audiences. With Lord Beaverbrook, proprietor of the Daily Express, on November 22, 1935, with Stanley Baldwin's private secretary Tom Jones on May 17, 1936, with the conductor Sir Thomas Beecham on November 13, 1936, and with many others. While these records have since vanished, Ribbentrop's own notes have now surfaced. He reported to Hitler that he had assured Tom Jones again and again that ever since Hitler had begun with seven men in Munich, quote, absolute cooperation and friendship between Britain and Germany had been a cornerstone of his foreign policy, unquote. Ribbentrop would explain to the Turkish diplomat Asakalin in 1941 that far from being the Führer's, quote-unquote, evil genius, the fact was that he had always advised Hitler to bend over backward to secure Britain's friendship. As ambassador in London, Ribbentrop would now secretly offer Baldwin an, quote, offensive and defensive alliance, unquote. It was a tragedy that Hitler knew so few Englishmen. He had met the Mitfords, Sir Oswald Mosley, Lords Londonderry and Rothermere, and the journalist Ward Price, and Major General J.F.C. Fuller, the acknowledged British tank expert, had also confidentially seen him. In September 1936, the wartime Prime Minister David Lloyd George spent 2 weeks in Germany as his guest, and admiringly wrote in the Daily Express how Hitler had united Catholic and Protestant, employer and artisan, rich and poor, into one people, ein Volk, in fact. The British press magnate Cecil King would write in his diary 4 years later, quote, Lloyd George spoke of Hitler as the greatest figure in Europe since Napoleon, and possibly greater than him, unquote. Lloyd George revealed that in 1918 the British were on the point of throwing in the sponge, since Field Marshal Earl Haig had indicated that the Allied offensive could not continue much longer. Hitler would not tire of repeating the point to his weary generals when their own war entered its bleaker years. In June, there was another contact with the Anglo-Saxon world when William Mackenzie King, the Canadian premier, had a 2-hour talk with Hitler. He wrote in his diary his favorable impression of the Nazis, quote, constructive, unquote, work. To Hitler, however, the flavor of all the reports from London was that, despite his secret assurances, Britain had resumed a barely concealed rearmament effort, particularly for the RAF, and there was, therefore, a real time limit on achieving his secret strategic ambitions in the East. His military attaché reported from London on February 19th, 1937, quote, in any war, time will work for Britain, but only if she can survive initial defeats which would make it impossible for her to fight on, unquote. Hitler had explained to Ribbentrop back in 1935 that he was not proposing to repeat Admiral von Tirpitz's earlier error in getting involved in an arms race. He was going to concede naval supremacy to the British and hope that they would make him a similar concession with regard to Germany's future land armies. In September 1938, however, the German naval staff would sadly summarize, quote, "The realization has dawned on the Navy and the Führer over the last 1.5 years that, in contrast to what the Führer had hoped for at the time of the signing of the naval agreement, Britain cannot be excluded as a possible future enemy." End quote. Hitler had certainly not anticipated this quote-unquote estrangement. He privately told Julius Schaub and others on his staff that it would not have occurred had Edward VIII not been forced to abdicate in December 1936. His successor, the weak and ill-prepared King George VI, was wholly in the grip of his, quote, "evil and anti-German advisors," unquote. When Edward, now Duke of Windsor, visited Berchtesgaden in October 1937, he told Hitler much that confirmed this view. Unfortunately, the record of their meeting would also vanish from the files captured in 1945. A less tangible reason for Hitler's restlessness was the realization that the years were slipping by, while his grand design was remaining unfulfilled. The same uninspiring faces assembled in the cabinet room. A civil servant, the Gestapo official Werner Best, who sat in on one such meeting in 1937, found that the Führer had become, quote, "increasingly nervous, bad-tempered, impatient, gloomy, abrupt, distrustful, unjust, dogmatic, and intractable, glowering," unquote, wrote Best. Quote, "He listened to the submissions of the Reich ministers and retorted in a surly voice, his aversion to topics, to the wrangling, and even to the people present was obvious," unquote. Hitler felt himself succumbing to the inertia of government bureaucracy. He took to appointing special plenipotentiaries to perform specific tasks. Cabinet meetings, as such, virtually ceased late in 1937. Instead, Hitler dealt directly, through Lammers, with affairs of state, and he began to communicate his will directly to the ministers and generals without discussion. With the end of cabinet government in Germany, things moved faster. Many times in 1937 and 1938, he spoke in private to Goebbels of his burning ambition to undo forever the humiliation inflicted upon Germany by the Peace of Westphalia, which had brought the Thirty Years' War to an end in 1648. A psychological requisite was the proper processing of public opinion. He was to explain in November 1938 with remarkable frankness, quote, "It was only by harping on Germany's desire and search for peace that I managed little by little to secure the freedom of action and the armaments that we needed to take each successive step," end quote. The first target would be Austria. He proposed to win her by peaceful means if possible. Earlier in July 1937, he had appointed an SS Gruppenführer, Dr. Wilhelm Keppler, to act as the Nazi Party's special agent for Austrian affairs, but he warned Keppler that he would not contemplate a revolutionary solution. That same month, Hitler was deeply moved by the participation at the big Breslau Song Festival of contingents from the German-speaking areas outside the Reich's frontiers. In Austria and Czechoslovakia. He made passing reference to his speech to, quote, 95 million Germans, unquote, of whom only 68 million were at present part of his Reich. The Austrian contingent, in bright national costumes, stormed his tribune. The women wept uncontrollably. When Goebbels showed him the newsreels, Hitler ordered them suppressed to avoid reprisals against the Austrians seen cheering him. But it was a scene to which he frequently referred in private during the coming months. Visiting Goebbels' villa at Schwanenwerder on the day after the festival, he confirmed that he was planning to take a, quote, "clean sweep," unquote, in Austria, and that Czechoslovakia's turn would follow. There was a large German minority. quite apart from the 150,000 counted in 1930 in the more remote Slovakia, there were 3.5 million ethnic Germans, quote-unquote, trapped in Bohemia and Moravia by the artificial frontiers which were created by Czechoslovakia in 1919. Hitler denied the Czechs any right to be in Bohemia and Moravia at all. They had not filtered in until the 6th or 7th centuries. Quote, "The Czechs are past masters at infiltration," unquote, he was to state in October 1941. Quote, "Take Vienna. Before the World War, only about 170 of the 1,800 imperial court officials were of German origin. All the rest, right up to the top, were Czechs." End quote. Most of the ethnic Germans lived in the border Sudeten territories, where Czech and French engineers had labored for years to erect fortifications. The Czech president, Dr. Edward Beneš, had ruthlessly enforced the, quote, Czechification, unquote, of the local administration of these territories. Hitler subscribed him inelegantly to Goebbels as, quote, a crafty, squinty-eyed little rat, unquote. Baron von Neurath had tried to induce him to mollify these policies without success. The question was, when should Hitler strike? Spitzi recalls one scene at this time, of Hitler scanning the latest agency reports through gold-rimmed spectacles while Ribbentrop peered over his shoulder. Quote, "Mein Führer," said Ribbentrop, "I think we shall soon have to draw our sword from its scabbard," end quote. Quote, "No, Ribbentrop," responded Hitler, "not yet," end quote. Blomberg's last directive to the Wehrmacht in June 1937 had been primarily defensive. It had dwelt upon only two minor contingencies. Quote, Otto, a German attack on Austria, should she restore the hated Habsburg monarchy, and Green, a surprise attack on Czechoslovakia, if France or Russia invaded. So there wasn't a quote there. It was Otto and Green that were in quotes, and I got confused. If France or Russia invaded Germany, because the Russian Air Force must first be prevented from using the now-completed airfields in Czechoslovakia. General von Fritsch, the Army's commander-in-chief, had dutifully ordered the Army to study ways of breaching the Czech fortifications. Lunching with Goebbels on November 5, 1937, Hitler asked the propaganda minister to go easy on the Czechs for the time being, as they could not do anything about them yet. Quote, "The Czechs are crazy," reflected Goebbels, describing this conversation in his diary. Quote, "They are surrounded by 100 million enemies whose land and people they have usurped. Na prost," unquote. Hitler also instructed him to downplay both their future colonial demands and the church problem. They had to keep their propaganda powder dry. To Hitler, it seemed that his army lacked enthusiasm. It certainly lacked ammunition and arms for a long conflict. Germany was gripped by a severe steel shortage. Early in 1937, the three services had been ordered to cut back their arms budget. The Navy argued emphatically against any reduction of warship construction now that Britain was emerging as a possible enemy too. The gap could not, however, be bridged in consequence of the launchings planned in 1938. Of the two battleships Bismarck and Tirpitz, all construction would have to be postponed except for one cruiser and one carrier. The Luftwaffe pointed out that it was getting 70,000 tons of steel a month. At Blomberg's suggestion, Hitler called the commander-in-chief to the chancellery to settle the dispute. Such was the background of one of Hitler's most portentous secret conferences, the so-called quote-unquote Hossbach Conference of November 5, 1937, the afternoon of his admonitory talk with Goebbels. Hitler decided to use this opportunity to reveal to them some of his secret goals, or as he put it to Goering, quote, to put some steam up Fritsch's pants, unquote. Colonel Friedrich Hossbach, his Wehrmacht adjutant, wrote a summary 5 days later of the proceedings. Part of this has survived. So has a telegram sent by the French ambassador reporting that he had learned of Hitler's long meeting and of the large number of generals and admirals summoned to the chancellery. It was not a formal cabinet meeting. The subject was far too important for such an audience, Hitler explained. But to lend solemnity to the proceedings, as he told Goering, he did invite Foreign Minister von Neurath, along with Blomberg, Goering, Rader, and Fritsch, to join him in the glass-walled conservatory of his, quote, official residence, unquote, a wing of the Chancellery. The glass doors were closed and a thick curtain drawn across. The dozen or so munitions and economics experts, whom Blomberg had also rounded up, fruitlessly as it turned out, had to kick their heels for the next 4 hours in the smoking room next door. When the rest of the conference ended at 8:30 p.m., the word passed around. Quote, "The Navy has won, and only the Navy gets 20,000 tons," end quote. In that part of the speech of which Hossbach's record has survived, Hitler reiterated his determination to launch a war to solve Germany's Lebensraum problems within the next 5 or 6 years. As a first stage, he might, under certain circumstances, order, quote, a lightning attack, unquote, on neighboring Czechoslovakia during 1938. Hitler's view was that Britain had already tacitly written off Czechoslovakia and that France would follow suit. He was so emphatic that Fritsch proposed canceling his projected leave in Egypt due to start in 10 days' time. No objections were raised, either then or later. A directive relating to Green was issued by Blomberg's ministry on December 21st. The western frontier defenses would have to be improved, but Hitler would try to avoid war on two fronts and taking any other military or economic risks. Should the political situation not develop as desired, Green might have to be postponed for some years. On the other hand, the directive said, a situation might arise depriving Czechoslovakia of all her potential allies except Russia. Quote, then Green will take effect even before Germany is fully prepared for war, unquote. Blomberg's directive shows how little he appreciated the full scope of Hitler's ambitions. As anyone who had read chapter 14 of Mein Kampf knew, Hitler had set his sights much further afield. From his very first speeches, he had drawn attention to Russia's open spaces, and if we apply the only proper yardstick, if we examine his long-term material preparations, only one conclusion remains, that his quote-unquote dreamland, his new empire, awaited him in the East. One such clue is in German Admiralty files, a letter from the naval commandant at Palau in East Prussia, reporting a conversation between Hitler and the local party Gauleiter Erich Koch in June 1937. Hitler had, he said, warned of Palau's coming importance as a naval base, quote, even more powerful than Kiel or Wilhelmshaven, unquote, to accommodate a bigger fleet in the future years. Quote, in the Führer's view, the time will come in, say, 6 or 7 years, when Germany can progress from her present defensive posture to an offensive policy. Within Europe, this kind of development will only be possible toward the East. End quote. It is regrettable that no records have been found of most of Hitler's important speeches to his Gauleiters, like that on June 2, 1937, to which Koch was probably referring. One speech to party leaders survives on discs. In this harangue, delivered on November 23, 1937, he proclaimed, quote, "The British purchased their entire empire with less blood than we Germans lost in the World War alone. World empires are won only by revolutionary movements," unquote. He is heard adding later, quote, "Today the German nation has at last acquired what it lacked for centuries, an organized leadership of the people." Unquote. Hitler was not interested in overseas conquests. Therefore, when Lord Halifax, the British statesman, visited him in Bavaria on November 19th to discuss colonies for Germany in Africa, he failed to excite the Führer's interest. By the end of 1937, it was clear that the coming year would be dominated by two factors. By Hitler's ardent resolve to begin his fight for Lebensraum, and by the growing certainty that Britain would do all she could to thwart him. On December 27th, Ribbentrop, now Hitler's ambassador in London, submitted to him an analysis of Britain's attitude. And there's an asterisk, so I'll check that out. This document, which the author obtained, clearly proves that Ribbentrop did warn Hitler that Britain would fight. The document was quote-unquote not found by the editors of the Allied official publication, Documents on German Foreign Policy. And back up. She now regarded Germany as her most deadly potential enemy, he said. Chamberlain was currently formulating a new initiative with the hope of purchasing peace in Europe, in return for which the British would offer colonies and certain concessions on Austria and Czechoslovakia. But, he warned, while the British were largely in favor of a lasting agreement with Germany, there was a hostile ruling class that could always swing the British public around to support war, for example, by atrocity mongering against the Nazis. There was, wrote Ribbentrop, a quote-unquote heroic ruling class that would not shrink from war to protect their material interests as a world power. Quote, when Britain sees the odds improve, she will fight, unquote. Quote, if Britain continues in future to block Germany at every turn, then there can be no doubt that the two nations will ultimately drift apart. Nonetheless, it seems proper to me that our future policies should remain anchored to striving for agreement with Britain. The embassy will therefore work consistently toward an Anglo-German entente. End quote. On January 2, 1938, Ribbentrop significantly amended this view. Quote, today, he wrote to the Führer, I no longer believe in rapprochement. Britain does not want a Germany of superior strength in the offing as a permanent threat to her islands. That is why she will fight. End quote. The upshot was a demand by Hitler later in January for a strengthening of the German fleet. By the end of 1944, there were to be 4 battleships, although not the 6 the Navy had previously planned. On January 21st, he delivered the first of many secret speeches to his generals. An anonymous 3-page summary exists, showing that Hitler began with a description of the Roman Empire, and how thereafter Christianity had given Western civilization the inner unity it needed to stave off Eastern invasions. Quote, only one man can lead, but that man shoulders the entire burden of the responsibility. It is a grave burden. Believe me, generals, my nerves have gone to pieces, and I just cannot sleep any longer for worry about Germany. Unquote. Germany's food situation was particularly grim. Quote, Germany's position is really bleak. Day and night I battle with the problem. One fact leads me to believe, however, that there may be hope for the German nation yet. If we look closely at the ruling nations of this earth, the British, French, and Americans, the statistics that show only a vanishingly small component of them, perhaps 40 or 50 million pure-blooded citizens of the ruling country, are controlling millions of other human beings and gigantic areas of the world. There is only one nation on earth, living in the heart of Europe, in the great compactness of uniform race and language, tightly concentrated, and that is the German nation, with 110 million Germans in Central Europe. This comparison gives us cause to hope. One day, the entire world must and shall belong to this united bloc of Central Europe. End quote. And end chapter.